Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I'm quite dreading the ride back.
It's a long way, Ned.
It's a long way.
Mine's 90. I found my nice routes now. It's through Richmond Park. It's about 3Ks longer.
Have you still got the record in Richmond Park? You can't have.
Like,
you
surely.
Said that years ago, didn't you?
But yeah.
What was it?
I've rode it for 13 minutes. Does that make sense?
It's 6 and a bit miles or something round, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it was around 13 minutes.
Wow. Yeah.
It was really fast.
Who timed it?
We did. I was on my full TT bike.
Right. Okay.
And it was the week after I'd won the Giro time trial.
You're going quite well.
I was going quite well.
Was that when you came over for the London Nocturne and rode away from everyone at the London Nocturne? Or was that the Edinburgh Nocturne?
No, that was the Edinburgh Nocturne. I did that.
But that was the same. Was that the same song?
Cameron Meyer. Yeah, it might have been actually.
Cameron Meyer?
Yeah.
God, all these names from the past.
Blast from the past, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Whatever happened to Cameron Meyer?
Whatever happened to the Nocturnes?
Yeah,
they were cool.
They were really cool, actually.
Your sister was involved with them, wasn't she?
She was. That's where it all started.
James Pope and all that sort of thing.
Face partnership back in the day.
Yeah. What a shame. So much has been ripped out of the British scene, hasn't it?
Like all of it.
Whole thing.
The whole thing's gone.
It has, really.
Yeah. It's kind of gone back. Do you have to question whether it's just gone back to its default setting? Kind of, it's not part of our kind of cultural makeup, is it?
And it honestly doesn't seem to be having an obvious and immediate impact on the amount of British riders who are making it through to World Tour level. That's the fruitcake thing about it. That's the really surprising thing that, you know, we were talking today in the commentary about Sam Watson.
Yeah.
He's had nothing to do with British cycling. He's come through the Pidcock school of hard knocks.
It's basically gone back to its default setting where you have to do it on your own.
Yeah.
You have to go across the continent and there's no... Yeah, it's really interesting, actually. I think it's because that's the old Foreign Legion. It's like that. The amount of British riders in the World Tour now... Is it more than ever? And yet scattered across teams. We keep seeing names like, oh,
yeah,
never heard of you. And yeah. And they're all just doing it kind of their own way. It's really interesting.
Yeah.
That's just the way it is. So, I mean, I think actually, I think the junior scene's pretty interesting here. There's a lot of goodwill and a lot of people putting in a lot of effort to kind of keep the junior scene alive. And I think, but beyond junior, you've got to ship out. You got to go and go abroad.
Yeah.
Go to the continent.
Yeah.
And find your way.
I think it's patchy, isn't it? I think it varies from kind of region to region. I did a charity event a couple of weeks ago, 10 days ago or something, up in near Edinburgh for a really big cycling club in Livingston called, can't remember what they're called, Clarion something, Lothian Clarion, anyway, whatever. It was the cyclocross British national champion Cameron Mason.
Yes, who, Ex-Trinity,
who is a really nice kid. And anyway, he did a fundraiser and they'd asked me if I'd come up and interview him on stage. And I'd not met him before. It's lovely. But anyway, I say that by token of, if that's even a grammatical sentence, completing what you're saying. Because their cycling club there, just a cycling club sort of thing, they've got about 500 members or something. Mm. But 200 of those members are kids.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. And that's actually quite anomalous, I think.
Yeah.
Like, normally the model is like, if you've got 500 members, 450 of them are men in their 50s.
Yeah, and then, true.
And then there's 17 children.
Yeah.
And the rest are women. But actually, there are clubs where the kids really are. And they kind of, like, that is a virtuous circle thing, isn't it? Because they just...
And their friends are doing it.
Their friends are doing it, so they get involved. And then it kind of grows exponentially from that.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Which is exactly what happened to Sam Watson.
Yeah, because it's... But I'm in awe and admiration of all the kind of the dads out there who kind of put so much time into it. Dads and mums. I mean, to be fair, a lot of the time it's the dads who are already cyclists, but yeah, and the mums and the families.
Yeah.
But you have a lot of the kind of trained to be coaches and then get really hands-on with it.
Yeah.
And that's, I guess that's just the way it has to be. And it does seem to work really well, oddly.
Yeah.
It's probably a healthier way than the British cycling kind
pressure
of
cooker.
Yeah, the kind of podium program and yeah. the binary sense of success or failure. Did you make the program or not?
Yeah.
Which wasn't productive, but it had a lot of collateral damage.
Case in point, Jermaine Burton. You remember Jermaine?
Yes. Yeah.
He was never like a square peg in a round hole. He was never the right kind of character to, you know, thrive in that kind of like black and white world of the podium program. And yet he was a talent, and he should be a pro now. He should be enjoying his racing.
And in many ways, I think perhaps that's a really good thing, because the podium program was obviously exactly what it says in the tin. It was kind of make it or break.
Yeah.
Whereas actually, I think with a lot of these junior programs, as you said, the social aspect and the actual personal growth by doing that, there's not this sense of kind of, you're going to make it, and if you don't, you've kind of sacrificed so much. There's a lot of kind of whatever you get from it is going to help you not only get through adolescence kind of healthily, but then introduce you to a healthy environment, kind of good life attitudes, meet interesting people, which I think is a really, and which is probably a lot more valuable when you consider that it's in like a one percentile that make it.
Yeah.
So there's 99%. So you have to be doing the whole program for the 99% to kind of make it beneficial and a life enhancement. So hats off to all those people who listen to this podcast who do that, because I think it's truly admirable, because it takes a lot of time and commitment to do that.
Yeah. Anyway, that event was with the Pedal Power guys.
Oh, was it?
You remember the World
Legends?
Yeah, they got on that great event.
That's great.
Neil and the rest of them up there. Don't know if you listen to this podcast, but yeah. Do you remember that event at the World Champs? I had to do the raffle, and there were like 30 prizes. Do you remember?
Oh, God, that went on forever.
And the sponsor had to come. The sponsor had to come on and pose for a photograph with the winner of each raffle prize.
And your social battery was quite low by that point.
I'd done 6 hours of commentating with Chris Boardman. Sucked the life out of me.
That would suck your life out of anybody.
And then I did that, and yeah, so. But they'd had a similar thing at this event. They had 30 raffle prizes to give out. But I also had a train at 9:15 that I wanted to catch.
So you didn't even wait for the sponsors this
time? I was so ruthless, David. It was
a 3-second call.
Yeah. If you hadn't said, you know, it's my ticket number, I was just scrapping it.
Nice.
I was just absolutely in and out.
That's where raffle should be. Bingo, raffle bingo.
What was I going to say? Oh, yeah. Talking about casual sexism and forgetting the women's part in all this. We were rightly upbraided by a listener for not talking about when we did our chaotic podcast the other day from three different countries and an internet.
That was a terrible podcast.
It was an awful podcast. I apologize for that.
It was a really bad podcast.
It was a really bad podcast because we couldn't concentrate on anything other than buffering.
Yeah.
And we had loads of racing that we hadn't talked about, and we were trying to remember what the race was. We completely failed to mention anything that had happened in the women's peloton, which is a totally legitimate complaint. There hasn't been a great deal at World Tour level, to be perfectly honest.
No, they hadn't.
But the most recent... Mariana Voss.
That
was such a mad statistic. It was her first ever Omloop Het Nieuwsblad.
That is a mad stat, because I thought she'd won everything.
Especially that.
Yeah. Like beating Lotta Kopecky in the sprint.
Because normally she's like ripped everyone's heads off in the cyclocross season. Yeah. So she takes like a couple of weeks off, which is fair enough.
Yeah.
Before she smashes everyone in the road season. So that race has always fallen through a hole in her calendar. But she didn't, as far as I know, she didn't compete in the cyclocross winter. So she's obviously like peaked. She's not like she's going to rip everyone's heads off on the road.
So good.
But she was away in a really sort of top group, and it was a really interesting and dynamic. Like all the hitters were there: Lisa Longo Borghini, the world champion Lotta Kopecky, and then the next weekend, Kopecky just destroyed everyone at
Strada Bianchi.
But it was a much more, if you like, well, we had this debate yesterday on the pod. I was about to say it was a much more interesting race.
Yeah.
But actually, that's a stupid and fatuous thing to say, because they were
just
both...
You're just contradicting yourself from yesterday.
Exactly. And I don't mean interesting, but it was an interesting race. It's just that it was different.
It was a different dynamic.
But I'm pleased for Kopecky, because A, I think she's class. I think she's great. I remember talking to her at that thing you did.
Yeah.
Do you remember?
The Velodor.
Are you going to do that again next year?
I think I am, yeah.
You got the gig?
Yeah.
They've been back in touch?
Yeah, I'm going to practice my French a lot more at Tour de France. Might get fired up and Duolingo it. Go into advanced Duolingo and just kind of polish my French. So
That's such good fun. You had Eddie Merckx and Bernardino.
That was right.
Year one.
Who I
you
know.
Go, you know, like you're just interviewing Eddie Merckx and Bernardino in French.
It's nuts,
in front
it?
Of the cycling
wheel. I did get a photo with someone, gutted about that.
Who? You didn't?
No. I could have had a picture in my bookshelves of me with Eddie Merckx and Bernardino.
They'll be back next year.
That's true.
Yeah. They're going to have to be.
Next year, I'm going to make sure that's a priority number one at Velodor this year, is getting a photo with them.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's to be done.
Anyway.
So bike race was pretty dull today. It would have been exceptional.
Oh, it was extremely dull.
It would have been exceptional if there was wind.
Yeah, so it was perfectly designed for wind, and you know, but that's the risk. We haven't had wind at Paris-Nice for a few years, you know, as far as I remember.
And it's dry.
It's sunny and very benign conditions, so it was a stinker today. And not only that, but I complained as soon as you came into the office when we were making notes, waiting for the race to start. I showed you the profile.
This was fair. This was fair.
I said there are two. So it's not entirely flat today. There were some little climbs. Like none of them were even a kilometer in length, I don't think. But they were climbs, and you know, I've seen much smaller climbs than that become categorised climbs at the Tour of Britain and other races. It's perfectly legitimate to have a climb that isn't really a climb.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a point of interest in the race, especially when you've got a King of the Mountains competition that was kind of like quite spicy yesterday, and chances are it'll carry on today, which it did. But the race organisers, and I don't understand why they do this, planning it in advance, they go, right, we know that we probably only have helicopter coverage, television coverage for the last 80 kilometres. Let's put the two categorised climbs in the opening 60 kilometres so that no one will see them.
Yeah. Okay, to be fair, there was only really one climb they could have used.
In the live helicopter bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they could have used it, couldn't they?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, they could have used it.
And even if...
And then it would have been double points.
And even if, yes, and even if that meant putting a third... Why not put a third categorised climb in? What's the problem with doing that?
Yeah. But it is... Actually, to our listeners, because we didn't mention this, there's another new initiative there, so every single of the final climbs of the day has double points.
Yeah.
Just to really make it interesting. Then they do that today, so it makes no matter. You can't see it.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm.
Yeah.
Be gutted if you're a Total Energy, spanking all that money in a cycling team.
Yeah.
And then the only thing you can get out of Paris-Nice is the climber's jersey. And then they're not showing it.
Yeah.
Bike racing, man.
Yeah.
Do you see, oh, you know, we were really harsh on, we really do know what we're talking about.
Do we?
The one cycling thing. You know that thing where it was like $250 million Saudi money or something.
Oh, the one cycling.
The one cycling.
I think you said the one cycling thing we know.
Oh, no,
I was trying to think, what's that?
We completely predicted what was going to happen there.
It's what, all like nothing?
It's nothing. It's all just fallen flat on its face.
Has it?
Yeah, completely.
Yeah.
Because in the small print of this deal, where there was going to be like €250 million, the teams were going to be liable for 100 million of it.
Oh dear.
It's like, oh, oh really?
We've got to pay?
We've got to pay you back some of that money? That's not
so that's all
work.
Just gone away for now.
It's just all vaporized. Yeah. And obviously Christian Prudhomme was just like, no, that's not going to happen.
It's interesting, isn't it? This kind of like assumption in the West and all these sports are running around with craven begging bowls out for the Saudi money. You kind of, they kind of think, or we think, or you know, there's an assumption that you just go to the Saudi Arabians and say, can we have a shitload of money for absolutely no reason? And they'll just go, yes, sure, because we're really stupid. Like the Saudis are stupid.
Because that's nothing to us. Yeah, $250 million, that's fine. Just take it.
Yeah.
Just keep it.
Yeah.
And,
I think they kind of know what. Talking about Saudi Arabia, right? Have you seen that mega city they're building?
Oh,
the line.
That's insane. Are they actually building it?
They've started.
That's wild.
They're keeping it like really secret squirrel, but satellite imagery has shown that they have already started over the last year or two excavating.
Was it like 80 Ks or something?
Something like that, 80 or 90 Ks of... So that for those of you who don't know, it's in the south of Saudi Arabia. They are intending to build a 9 million inhabitant megacity called The Line, which will consist of a straight line of mirrored glass tower block, effectively, that is... like 200 meters wide, 500 meters tall, and 90 odd kilometers long.
So weird.
And it will have there'll be no cars. So it's built, it's supposed to be like sustainable. It generates its own, you know, it's all solar paneled on the outside and all that kind of thing. Generates its own, it's completely kind of like, I mean, I believe that when I see it. And also, what about the carbon debt of actually pouring all that concrete in the first place? Absolutely astronomical.
Yeah.
But some of the principles of it, might be kind of like quite sensible. I don't know, but it is the weirdest thing. And just
that is
the
super
arrogance
weird.
And the kind of like extraordinary kind of like, we'll just build it anyway. And they've actually started.
That's amazing.
But a lot of the top architects who were involved, because they just went around the world saying, can we have Norman Foster? Yes. Can we have da-da-da-da?
Yeah.
You know, all the kind of like, but a lot of them one by one have just silently withdrawn from the project because they realize it's absolute...
Like an white elephant.
Bonkers.
That is wild. be a strange place to live.
Yeah. Really strange. Yeah. Like, I don't even know. You never would never have been there. But Milton Keynes shopping centre.
I do know. I was. I used
when
to
did
go,
you
to,
go to Milton Keynes shopping centre?
When I lived in Aylesbury.
You've been to Milton Keynes shopping centre?
Milton Keynes shopping centre.
So you know what I mean?
I do know exactly what you mean.
I think when it was built, it was like the longest continuous corridor. Yeah. I don't know. Something like that. Like, so it's like that, but much updated. We used to go, because I grew up in Bedford, and the McDonald's that opened up.
My God, yeah, we went to McDonald's.
It was like one of the very few McDonald's back there, back in the day. So we actually went, jumped in the car. Dad used to drive our Datsun estate. We used to drive for half an hour to go and get a McDonald's.
That's wild. I've been to that McDonald's. There you go.
That's a conversation.
1980s.
I never thought I'd be having.
1980s British English life.
1980s.
Yeah. Those are the days. Yeah.
But I remember it so clearly. Dad would say, well, there's this American hamburger restaurant. I think we should visit it. And it was so exciting. So excited. Dad used to do things like take the tray back and say, thank you very much, that was lovely. Like it was a restaurant. Let me look at the menu.
Innocent day.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Yeah. So, bike race.
Yeah, so it was interesting in the sense that
there was an interesting King of the Mountains battle that we didn't see.
That was interesting that we didn't see. We have
so
no
Jonas
idea
Rich
about.
Won the first one to put 3 points between him and Burgado. And Burgado, seemingly, we don't know, haven't seen the video, but I know that Pierre Latour finished second on the next climb that carried the double points. So his teammate Pierre Latour must have assisted Burgado to get to the next climb. And because he finished first, his teammate finished second and Rutsch could only manage third. Then he's turned tables on Rutsch and he's got the jersey.
That's wild. I wish we'd seen that because Rutsch must have caught out because he was faster than Burgado yesterday.
He's stronger and faster. Yeah, so especially on a non-climb climb.
Makes me think they did like a sneaky two-up attack from
that would be
KL.
Very Pierre Latour to do that.
Super Pierre Latour. And where were EF? You know, it's one job.
Yeah.
It's like, can you just get rolled completely like that? That's disappointing. I'd be disappointed if I were them.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a shame we didn't see that because that would have been
like
the highlight of the
day. In that little tussle, it's one all, isn't it? Effectively between those two teams because Burgado lost out because of the superior tactics of the team yesterday, I suppose.
But yeah, you're only as good as your last win.
You actually said when we saw Pierre Latour on the live coverage yesterday, you went, is he still a thing?
How old is he?
A million. No, he can't be that old. He was quite young when he kind of came on the scene. So I'd say 30. Shall I have a look?
Yeah, have a look.
I'm going to guess 33.
I'm going to guess that he's 182 centimetres.
Here we go.
This is my new thing, guessing cyclist height.
I guess his age.
Yeah, so right. I got...
Have you got him?
Yeah. Go 181 centimetres.
That's very good. And he is 30. See, he's young.
He's 30.
He's only 30.
Do you remember one of the first Vueltas we commentated on when he won a stage? Like a mountain stage, and he just looked like he was going to blow every 500 metres, and he managed to take it to the line on one of those steep, steep...
I do remember the stage.
And it was like a day-long breakaway.
2016,
and we'd never...
so he was 22.
Yeah.
No, he's a kid, wasn't he?
Yeah. So, he's been around.
Yeah. Oh, he's got a beard as well. That's three bearded French TotalEnergies riders, isn't it? Tourgis.
Oh, actually, talking of French, what was the interesting thing about Groupama FDJ today, which I think is very symbolic of how the sport's changing? So although British scene is kind of crumbling down, we do have one legacy, which is now overriding everything.
Which isn't good. It's not a good thing.
No, it's not a good thing.
It's not a good thing. No. Anyway, the thing is that Marc Madiot has permitted... I don't think he gets involved, because I really genuinely don't think he speaks much English.
No.
But they've got a new... Aussie DS.
Oh, look who it is.
Kiwi.
Yeah.
Aussie, I think, DS. Don't know who it is on the race. And he apparently is allowed to do the team talk in English.
Huh.
Which is genuinely kind of... that's groundbreaking for Marc Madiot. How he's kind of like got to the position where he's had to relinquish his one stand against the inevitable march of modernity.
Yeah,
it's happened.
Because that...
It's happened.
And I think that also... says, well, we know that Maddie O's stepped back now and the anglicisation of the sport is complete if Groupama FDJ are doing their team meetings in English.
Yep.
And I think actually a lot of the young French riders now want to speak English. You know, it was kind of just not a thing before, yeah. But now they enjoy it.
Well, the team they've got at this race, Sam Watson's from Leeds, Lawrence Pithier's from Christchurch, New Zealand, and by the way, he leads Paris-Nice, but we'll come to that in a second. Kevin Genietz is from Luxembourg, Sven-Erik Bustrom is Norwegian. That leaves three riders who are French. So they're in the minority.
Mm-hmm.
David Gaudu, Quentin Pachet, and Clément Rousseau. And it's interesting because I don't think Gaudu speaks a word of English.
That's brilliant.
So we'll have to learn.
Huh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's the case now. The peloton is now, its lingua franca is English. It's done. It's
never to come back.
The English virus has taken over professional cycling.
And that's a one way thing, isn't it? That's not coming back.
It's never coming back, which is kind of sad as well.
Really sad.
Because now you go across abroad and you never have to learn another language.
I mean, I think back to the days that you won't remember, but when I first started at ITV and when you were still racing, when we arrived at the start of the tour, and you remember the old medicals?
Yes, I do, yeah.
Two days at the Permanence, each rider would have to turn up and have their heart rate and their blood pressure. Yeah, they
do blood pressure, lay on anything, really take your shirt off.
Like, are you alive?
Yeah.
Yeah, fine, you're alive.
Yeah.
And it was a bit of cinema, wasn't it?
It was complete cinema. Yeah.
The Armstrong.
Yeah.
In its prime doping years. Yeah. Going through these kind of like medical tests. It was crazy, really. But you would have fallen victim to it. We used to lurk with Steve Doherty and Matt Rendell and John Tinetti in a little room right next to the medical room. And the riders would come out of the medical room and be ambushed by Rendell.
Nice.
Every rider in the peloton, 198 back then,
wow,
with nine-man teams. 198 riders. Rendell would get every single one of them to sit in a chair, turn to camera, and in their native tongue say to the camera, "You're watching the Tour de France on ITV."
That's brilliant.
Say, "Buongiorno, sono Alessandro Petacchi." sul ITV. Like that. And of course, they'd all get it slightly wrong, you know, but it was great fun. Little Basque climbers, Iban Mayo and people like that saying it. So you would have probably done one.
Yeah, I must have done.
I mean, you obviously, you know, can't remember it. But I remember occasionally, like, you didn't get everyone because Lance wouldn't have done it, I don't think. And, like, there are a few riders who was just a bit beneath them and they were wise enough not to sort of fall into Rendell's trap. But I remember once Jan Ulrich being so surprised by Rendell that he just found himself sitting there by mistake. And Jan back then didn't speak a word of English. And Matt had to try his German out on Jan.
Oh, wow.
That was great. But
those are the days, Ned.
Those were the days. But that was my introduction to sort of, and I come from football, which is an Anglophone kind of environment. And I loved the fact that it was just this absolute Tower of Babel.
Yeah.
Of mostly Mediterranean languages, you know. And then those riders who weren't British, you know, from Germany, and even Lance, you know, they had to kind of mix in and talk all these differently. You were obviously very good at it. And like, I thought it's great. Yeah. And I think that's a little bit sad, I must admit. Game's gone.
Yeah.
So, it was a funny old sprint in the end, wasn't it?
It was, and
a funny intermediate sprint.
That was a funny intermediate sprint.
We made a bit of a haul.
Well, I thought, because it was a front camera, so you couldn't see.
No.
So we'll take that as kind of not
knowing. Because you finished second, so that was tricky.
So, Lilo Trek were there, and obviously Mads Pedersen in the green jersey. We didn't know where the GC riders were going to be going for it. None of the GC riders were, apart from Scale Moser, who was up there in front of Mads Pedersen.
So Lidl Trek were being a bit like,
shall we? Let's do it.
And then let's do it for both of us.
Yeah.
For both of our ambitions, you know, because Pedersen lurking there in the general classification, that actually put him, he did finish second, but we thought he was working for Scale Moser, and then it turns out he did finish second rather than third.
Yeah.
Scale Moser picked up 2 seconds, you know, so it was odd. It was an odd one.
It was messy. That's for sure. So that was a very exciting bit. And then
Then it got unexciting.
It was just kind of curtain drawn across the road. DSM Firmenich on one side, Alpecin de Koenig on the other for like 15, 20 Ks.
Yeah.
And then with like 2 Ks to go, it was opened up to like a 3-lane road. Peloton was everywhere. And then we were actually just talking before that about Tudor and saying, how this non-World Tour team were kind of making a name for themselves with their Arvid Deklein sprinter.
Yeah,
and
it's proper good, isn't it?
And they just nailed it. They really just punched through with like 2Ks to go.
Trentin took them up.
And essentially just delivered.
Yeah.
And Arvid Deklein just really did kind of pummel everybody. But his lead-out man was there 200 metres to go, leading him out perfectly.
Yeah.
So they got everything right. And none of the other teams even looked close to getting it right. Visma Lisa bike, they were nowhere.
It was Eduardo Affini.
Who was on the front on his own.
He got on the front on his own. For what reason? Like,
well, often in that situation, when it's that chaotic, and as far as you know from the team meeting, you guys are going for it.
So the one thing you don't want
to
do
is... If you're at the front, just go. Because it's their job to find you. It's not you to kind of look back and figure out where they are. Because it's also so dangerous and you're flat out and everything's going around. And it's like, sometimes you get to the front and it's just like, oh God, I made it to the front, I'm going. And they'll figure it out behind me.
Yeah,
and
I get that, yeah.
And as it happened...
And also you don't want to be... stood accused of like not having done the effort.
Well, the worst is you get up there and you look behind, and because it's all so frantic, in that looking behind and easing off two or three pedal strokes, all of a sudden your team comes flying by you, and then you've got no chance of helping them.
Damn.
Which, yeah, it's like, yeah, it's so close. So the kind of rule of thumb is when you're at the front in that situation is just don't look back, do it. You get your job done, and they'll find you. And that's often the way with sprinters. And lead outs as well. It's a sprinter and their lead out man. It's their job to find you, not for the kind of the workers beforehand to find them. They kind of got their job, get to the front. Because often you'll see the sprinter and the lead out guy drifting around as a pair.
Yeah.
And either jumping between different lead outs. And if they see their team grouping, they'll go onto it. But you kind of, they almost operate as two separate entities.
That's very Mercou Cavendish, isn't it? They're very good at that.
Exactly.
Or they were a couple of years ago. Yeah.
They kind of bounce around. Yeah. And so I guess that's why Affini just found himself there and was like, just go.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, fair enough. That does make sense. But they were nowhere near him. You
know? Nowhere
near. He had no idea. You're right. But I mean, very strange. It would be interesting, you know, if we do find out what happened to Coy, because he was nowhere near the front.
No.
At any point. It was very odd.
Yeah.
I mean, they were doing what seemed to be the right thing with 10K to go, weren't they? Like, just letting all the other teams just burn themselves
out.
It's
so counterintuitive as well sometimes, because they knew with 5Ks, so there were some narrow sections, a couple of corners, but then, I guess, and this is where Tudor nailed it, they knew with 3Ks to go, it was going to open up into this huge, wide road. So it didn't really matter where you were, as long as you were together.
Yeah.
Because you could punch through.
You could make the space.
Yeah. And they were organized and disciplined enough to do that.
Interesting.
Whereas Visma Lisa bike probably had the same direction, the same information, and just got themselves caught out with all that swamping. But
so they are human after all. That's, yeah. Yeah, they can find a way of losing a bike. In fact, they've lost two bike races today, haven't they?
Yeah, they have. Actually, we should talk about Tirreno Adriatico.
We should. We watched a fair amount of that.
And obviously the biggest news of the day is the new Giro helmet.
Yeah, I mean, it's just...
It's a monstrosity. I mean... Yeah, no, I mean, I say it's a monstrosity. I was at the vanguard of weird stuff.
Crazy.
Yeah,
so
I mean,
would have embraced
it. I'd have loved it. But...
I mean, that looks weird. Put it on my head.
Yeah, let's go. No one's used this before. I'm up. Yeah. But I mean, but even I drew the line with POC. I was at the end of my career, 2014, when POC, we were the first team. And the big white, which everyone uses now.
Yeah.
And it's very similar to kind of...
But with respect, David, you weren't in winning time trial.
Exactly. So no. So it's fine if you're winning and you're in the race, you can wear that silly thing. And it's like, you're kind of, they have to admit you're going for the performance advantage.
Yeah.
But if I was getting like 60th in a time trial at that point, I was like, I am not sacrificing style for speed at this point. It's like... The reward isn't there. You can sacrifice style for speed if there's a chance you're going to win, because then everyone forgets. And because winning is stylish. So it doesn't matter what you wear. But if you're not going to win, well, always choose style over speed.
Jonas is mountain domestic.
Yeah.
Give me 126.
Yeah. Don't wear it.
No, I'm all right.
It's so true. I mean, I'd have loved to have seen them on, like, I mean, obviously they've seen it at training camps and stuff, but on the team bus beforehand. You know, because everyone's knowing that it's going to go viral. And it's like, who's going to wear it first out of the bus? It's like, who's doing it?
They must have been crying with laughter.
They must have been crying with laughter. It's so good.
I don't know
good.
If they laugh at all at Jumbo Visma.
No.
I don't know, but
Visma Lisa bike, Ned.
Thank you. I can say it on the pod.
But
Gary dropped a Jumbo Visma yesterday.
This morning as well, apparently. Yeah, apparently they had to do multiple takes.
Oh, that's great.
It's great, isn't it? Yeah, it's not perfect.
But yes. No, this is another cycling thing. We're seeing a picture of Peyo Bilbao, who's got stitches in his bonks.
This is so good.
This is such a cycling thing because, and you have a great take on this, because, well, I got the intel from Daniel Freeb, who saw him down at the start this morning. So I can't actually see the stitches, but that's...
Must be on the top of his head.
Must be in, in his scalp.
Yeah.
But he got up for a pee at 5 o'clock in the morning. Got up for a pee at 5 o'clock in the morning and banged his head. Is it gone then? Yeah.
I forgot to wear my helmet tonight. That was a problem for me. Yeah, we are used to waking up at night to go to the toilet or whatever. Always in the dark, no? Just to not to disturb our roommates. And I just forgot one door that was slightly open. And yeah, just a stupid story. And nothing important.
You okay? And this was sort of 5 o'clock.
Basically, he banged his head in the middle of the night, getting up for a pee, and needed stitches, which is great, isn't
it? But the first thing I thought, because it's Paris-Nice, my teammate Christian Vandeveld used to have kind of Paris-Nice was his nemesis, and he'd have like a list of things. I made him write down a list of 10 things he hated about Paris-Nice once, just to kind of get it out.
I'd love to see that.
Yeah, I know. I'd love to dig it out. He probably remembers them vividly now. I mean, one was just being in France, because a lot of the Americans just didn't like racing in France. Being Frenched.
Yeah.
The other one was the hotels.
Like Bob Roll. How much does Bob Roll hate France?
Oh, my God. It's amazing. And it's... but the hotels in Paris-Nice, especially at the start, are just... awful. I mean, you can't open your suitcase in a lot of them.
Yeah.
I mean, it's back in the... Maybe the hotel's better now. But the fact that he's in a hotel room and it's also cramped. And you're sharing it with somebody.
Yeah.
And it's like you're right next to each other.
Yeah.
I mean, it's probably the double bed that they then split up kind of when it's going single. And so you're climbing out of your bed. Your suitcase is closed because it won't open.
Yeah.
You've then got to find your toilet. And it's... don't want to wake up your teammates. The light's off. And clearly he's just done one of those things where it's just like... Paris-Nice himself.
I can just see it, like, and cold as well. Like, I bet, like, a lot of the rooms were tiled, the floors.
Oh, yeah.
Like that, French and Italian hotels.
And you open the curtains and it's just car park.
Car park outside.
Miserable.
And also it's the part, especially the first 3 days of Paris-Nice before you get to the south or close. No, actually, probably longer than that before you get to the Riviera. Until you get to Nice.
Yeah.
But the rest of it is pretty remote, isn't it, Paris-Nice?
Middle of nowhere.
It's not geared for tourists, but I like that, though. I like that. It reminded me of that great story about Elie Gesbert. ruining all his teammates' rest day because they were all having a kip in the afternoon after their cafe ride, and he set the fire alarm off by burning a towel on his campanile heater. But I love it. I just love bike racing because the real world, they can't remove the race from the real world. The real world has its tentacles all over the peloton, doesn't it? Oh, and by the real world, I mean people banging their heads in the middle of the night going up for a pee. Can you imagine that in football?
No.
Lionel Messi can't play today because he had a pee in the middle of the night and banged his head. It's very darts, actually. There's a lot of darts. I don't want to talk about darts in every podcast, but there's a lot of darts injuries are just hilarious because they're always so mundane. They're always so mundane. Ironically, the greatest darts player of recent years, Michael van Gerwen, once missed one of the major tournaments because he'd slipped up on the tiled floor of his very polished kitchen and like fallen on his back and sprained his back.
Nice.
Gone like that. And the irony is his profession before he was a darts player is he's a tiler.
Oh, God. That's so good.
Anyway, so boy, Arvind Decline wins. And then, Lawrence Pithy.
That's amazing.
Third place yesterday, second place today.
See, I didn't... I mean, you were beating yourself up because you're calling him Australian and he's actually Kiwi.
Yep.
I thought he was French.
What, because he's running for Groupama?
Because it's called Laurence Pithy.
Laurence Pithy.
Yeah, it's like a super French name.
It works as a French name, yeah.
Laurence Pithy.
From Normandy, from Rouen, perhaps.
Or Vendée.
Or the Vendée.
Vendée.
Or Picardie. He used to ride for, what's that, Vichy Rouen.
Yeah, Vichy Saint-Quentin. That was Saint-Quentin, my team.
Yeah.
Roubaix.
Picked up to top 10 in the Tour de
Mavic Cup. Yeah.
Anyway, he's much better than that. And he won the Cadel Evans Road Race.
So he's on fire.
Second, and he picked up some top 10s at the Tour Down Under in sprints. So this hasn't come from nowhere. I first noticed him because I didn't watch any of the Australian races because they're in the middle of the night. But I did watch opening weekend and he was heavily involved in Kerner Brussels Gun. And in fact, when Van Aert accelerated for the first time and his race winning move, Pitti was the only rider who could go with him.
Really?
Yeah.
It's 185 centimetres.
God!
185 centimetres, 74 kilos.
He's 21?
21.
That's
yeah.
Young.
17th of July.
He's a former junior. What?
That's, when's your birthday?
11th.
Okay.
Well, who, which professional day. Cyclist shares a birthday with me? World Tour cyclist. Australian.
Ooh.
Sprinter.
Caleb Ewan.
Caleb Ewan.
Nice.
Carlton. We're listening to Carlton's commentary today.
He had a brilliant bit of history. Brilliant bit of history.
He had some great history, but he also had a great anecdote about meeting Caleb Ewan.
Oh, that was really good. Yeah. He was like, yeah.
In Oman.
And he, I love this.
And he said, but I met Caleb and I said hello to him. I said, how are you doing? How's the form? And Caleb went, yeah, fine, thanks. I think it went on a little bit longer than that, the anecdote. Then Carlton came up with a great thing about the Royal Victoria Hotel.
This
somewhere.
Was brilliant.
In Italy somewhere, and how Queen Victoria had visited it. I couldn't quite follow, but it needed the installation of a flushing toilet. Otherwise, she wouldn't have stayed there. But I think he described the period of time in which this incident had happened as being the Renaissance.
Which is about 300 years
yeah,
before.
Yeah, something like that. But I was doing also. I'm not going to, you know, that's entirely legitimate in cycling commentary to get your times.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm not going to hold that against Carlton.
You got some good 100-year war stuff in today.
1427. Montargis was laid siege to?
1327.
Did I say
1327?
Oh, I got the century wrong. Sorry, Carlton.
Sorry, Carlton.
I think it's 1427. Did I say 13?
It was a 100-year war. So, you know, you've given yourself wriggle room.
1427. Montargis was laid siege to by the Earl of Warwickshire by 3,000 English troops. And they were beaten off when they were flooded and drowned when they opened the sluice gates.
So I didn't say it because I didn't want to obviously go off on a complete podcast tangent.
But how does that work?
Number one, how does that work?
I don't know.
Number two.
Because I don't know how you mine the moon either and what you do with the stuff.
Well, sluice gates, so obviously that's a...
Moat?
It's a moat and it's obviously a very clever defensive design.
Yeah.
Where was the recon? You know... What is the Earl of Warwickshire doing?
I don't know.
Like, send some guys there, they're like, arrogant. Oh, look at this. This moat, that's dry. That seems pretty fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's some big gates there.
Oh, that must have been it. So they were in the dry moat.
Must have been. That's what I've...
With all their guns and their siege engines.
Yeah, yeah.
All waiting there. And then they just went, right, have a bit of that.
Open up.
Loo.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that beat them off. And that's, yeah. Yeah, Montargis. But I think eventually the city might have been taken. The other Montargis historical fact that I had, didn't get this in the commentary, David, this is amazing, is it relates to a true story that was made into a French melodrama on stage, and I think it first of all took the form of a novel and then was put into a stage show in 1814, and it was called Le Chien de Montargis.
Okay.
And its English translation is The Dog of Montage. And it tells the story. It's quite interesting. Because think about 1814. It's not that long since the French Revolution.
Napoleon's comeback, isn't it? Around 1814.
Yeah, he's now been declared. I'm trying to remember what Rob told me in Paris the other day.
Oh, yeah, you should know
he
this.
He is now the first marshal or the marshal or the provost or whatever. So he's not quite emperor. Has he declared himself emperor yet? He might have done.
I think it's...
But anyways, you know, it's... France had just undergone the bloody aftershocks of the revolution and all this, you know, your political retribution and this insane violence that kind of swept through France following the kind of Rousseauian philosophy of natural justice must be meted out for progress to happen. You know, this is kind of like this is modern thinking and it involved a lot of blood and gore. And so this story in 1814 was very much in keeping with the spirit of the times. It tells the story of the reign of Charles V and a French courtier to Charles V, a certain Aubry de Montdidier, was murdered in 1371. Okay?
Okay.
1371 by a man we subsequently found out called Robert Macaire. Mm-hmm. Right? And the only reason we know it's Robert Macaire who murdered Aubry de Montdidier, this courtier of Charles V, is because Aubry de Montdidier's dog knew that Macaire had been the killer and had witnessed it. And whenever Macaire came near this dog who'd survived the attack, the dog would growl at Macaire and try and attack him because he'd killed his master, right?
Right.
And this became the subject of a lot of gossip in the court. Like, did Macaire, why is the dog growling at Macaire? And Charles V went, there's only one way of finding out, right?
How?
A duel. on the Isle of Notre Dame in the middle of the yeah. in Paris. Yeah, a duel between the dog and Robert Macaire, armed with a cudgel.
What's a cudgel?
A stick.
Okay.
To beat the dog with, and they were set at one another, right? And the dog won the fight, and was pulled off Macaire. Macaire survived, but was clearly had lost the duel. And then confessed to his crime of having killed Aubry de thingy, Montdidier, and was then hanged.
Wow. This is a true story.
Yes, yeah, a true story.
Wow, that's weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
Why would you make hope for yourself when the dog can't really...
Well, there's no one else... I don't know.
It's like, okay, the dog beat me. I didn't kill him. okay, I killed him. Now hang me.
I killed him. And now hang me. I've had a bad day anyway. You might as well just hang me.
I'm humiliated.
Yeah. There you go. Random. That's kind of montage-y stuff. Yeah. And tomorrow's team time trial. Hopefully we'll get a view of those Visma Lisa bike helmets.
Oh, yeah, we will.
I mean, they do. Well, the one thing is they do make the Uno X ones look normal now.
Completely.
Because they're so out there.
Completely. I do wonder if the UCI are going to do anything on that. Because, I mean, it's going to be...
What's illegal about them?
Don't know, but that's the point. I don't know. Maybe they're going to have to create it. Because it's starting to look ridiculous. Maybe that's...
Or just bad for the sport.
Going down the... It's kind of started... So they got pretty strict rule the Lugano Charter, as we mentioned perhaps off the podcast, which is where in 1996, the Lugano Worlds, they had a meeting and decided that bikes had to be double triangle, stop these Lotus bikes and the Pinarello weird stuff. This... We have, again, let's not sacrifice style for speed. Yep. It's about the human performance. It's not about the equipment. So let's get some standardized kind of technological template that we can stick to. At some point, you might have to say, well, the human body, we can't kind of start to shift it around this much because it's starting to kind of look like ridiculous.
Yeah, you might be right, actually.
Because, well, you were saying the story of the dangler.
Yeah, which I mean, we've spoken
about
it before,
on the podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, I think at some point you've got to say, well, actually, where do we stop kind of with this kind of morphing the body for performance advantages?
And you know what the trigger or the mechanism for doing that might be? That they might be able to look at that helmet and go, actually, that's not that helmet. A helmet is designed to stop head injuries.
Yeah, exactly.
Does that do its job?
Well, it has to because it has to go through the regulations.
Oh, does it?
Yeah.
They test it for that?
Yes.
Yeah, it doesn't look like it would protect you.
I know.
It looks like shards of it would embed itself in your skull.
You've got a huge impact kind of space.
There must be a lot
there.
Of empty space in there.
Well, that's what I mean. It's like, it's great. It's probably a super safe helmet. You nailed it, though, because I was reading up on it afterwards. Because as soon as you saw it, because of your vast aerodynamic knowledge, you said, that's probably so that when they've got their head down or up, it's equally aerodynamic.
It mitigates against the effect of lifting.
And evidently that is.
Oh, is that right?
Well, yeah. Well done, Ned.
Thank you very much. All right. Well, team time trial tomorrow. And that was the story of stage two of Paris-Nice.
Hello, Ned and David. I'm driving back from Altea, which is in Spain. I stopped at Girona and now I'm in France. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I have no idea why I just did that.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.